This piece was brought to you by Chefs Collaborative, chefscollaborative.com.
Hi, this is Celia Kutcher, host of Animal Instinct, and you are listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Welcome to We Dig Plants on Heritage Radio Network. We are Groundworks, Inc. I'm Alice Marcus Krieg.
And I'm Carmen DeVito.
And we design and install and maintain gardens in and around New York City. Heritage Radio Network broadcasts from two shipping containers in Bushwick, Brooklyn, located next to Roberta's Pizza at 261 Moore Street. And there's a lot of people eating pizza today.
Oh, my God, yeah.
And I'm seeing a lot of mushrooms on those pizzas. So that's what we're going to talk about.
Yes.
Mushrooms.
It's a shroomy kind of day.
Yes. And our horticultural honor roll of the week.
Take it away, Jack.
I'll just do it myself. And who is it today, Carmen?
All right. So this week was the People's Climate March. I personally didn't attend.
No, I did not either. I was in Connecticut.
But, you know, it was an amazing event.
310,000 people in New York City.
Yeah.
All on the Upper West Side. God bless.
Yeah. All those people.
It looked really awesome, I have to say.
There was a lot of people really passionate about it.
And, yeah.
And as New Yorkers, you know, we don't like to be invaded by a lot of people. We get
well. I think it was New Yorkers.
It was
you know,
and the surrounding area.
Yeah, you know? The tri-state.
So anyway, I thought this week in sympathy with the Climate March, and to do something a little bit different because we usually honor either people who are older or long dead, or you know, dead German botanists a lot. Victorian lady, repressed Victorian lady, you know, taxonomist. This week, we're going to honor two young pioneers. And this does have something to do with mushrooms. So back in 2007, Eben Bayer and Gavin McIntyre were attending the Rensselaer Polytechnic Institute.
Upstate New York,
a great university. And they found a new way to use mushroom mycelium to create rigid molded materials. Now that sounds incredibly boring, right? But listen to what they've done. They found a way to take agricultural waste like chopped up straw, chopped up corn husks, rice hulls, all kinds of stuff that usually...
All the things that New York City Department of Sanitation now wants.
Yes. And well, that usually gets dumped and it's on a farm, and if it's not composted, it's dumped somewhere. They mix it with mushroom mycelium, they kind of inoculate it, and then they mix it together and they put it into these forms, and the mushroom mycelium grows. So it's growing things like packaging. So instead, you know when you buy a TV and you have those like styrofoam corners,
right.
So instead of that made out of petroleum, you know, products, it can be made from mushrooms.
Oh,
so
awesome.
it's rigid. They've also made insulation
and surfboards.
And surfboards. Right? That's right. So
I want a coat. I would like a coat.
Yes, and I was like, I want to smell it. Actually, I'm going to order a sample because I want to see if it smells kind of mushroomy. Because personally, I love the smell of mushrooms.
Yeah.
Umami.
Yeah.
You know, is like the most amazing thing. And so they've won so many awards. I can't even list them all. One of them is the Buckminster Fuller Award for, you know, innovation.
For freak product.
Richard Branson actually gives out a Screw Business as Usual Award.
Oh, awesome.
And they won that. And they've raised $14 million in equity capital. And they've opened up their plant right upstate New York. And they employ...
Next to Chobani?
No, I don't know. Maybe there's a symbiosis there between the milk and the mushrooms. But they employ hundreds of people, and they're continuing to do research and to create amazing things. So shout out to Eben Bayer and Gavin McIntyre. We're going to put videos of the actual process. You can see mushrooms making new kinds of packaging that when you bring it home, you don't have to throw it in the trash or not be able to recycle it. You can crumble it up and compost it.
Now, let's take this a step further, and don't you think it would be cool if you could now buy the paper, the mushroom paper, and do your 3D printing on the mushroom paper?
Exactly. I think
who's thinking?
Yes.
I'm using my noggin.
That's right.
All right, so somebody else that's got an amazing noggin is our interview this week. Here in New York City, we don't get to actually forage for mushrooms. So we're going to learn a lot from a really super great guy, Michael Heim, who does just that and has made himself a life from foraging for edibles. He lives in Boulder, Colorado, and he teaches and works at the 63rd Street Farm. And he is going to be part, I believe, of the Chef's Collaborative dinner that is part of the Sustainable Food Summit out in Boulder that Heritage is
the media sponsor
yeah. for. So welcome, Michael.
Hey, how are you doing?
Good. Thanks for joining us today.
Thanks. Yeah, my pleasure.
So tell us a little bit about yourself. You grew up in Nebraska and you studied political science in college. And then what?
I guess I had to take a class to basically finish my degree. I had to take a hard science class, so I took horticulture.
Uh-huh. I took earth science. I took marine biology.
Go ahead. Yeah.
Sorry, go ahead.
Oh, yeah. So anyway, it was around the same time that I came across foraging for wild mushrooms. A friend of mine took me foraging along the Platte River in Nebraska.
Uh-huh.
And it kind of took hold. So, yeah, now I'm... Here we are.
So I think most people remember the beautiful story, Into the Wild.
That's a great movie and book.
It's such an amazing story. But it, of course, it has a super sad ending. And unfortunately, I think a lot of people equate foraging with that completely unthinkable outcome of where the young man eats the wrong thing and dies. So... tell us what it's like to find and taste your first edible. How did you kind of know what to eat?
Well, I think I have two stories about this. I guess one of them is really quick. When I was a kid, I would eat clover.
Uh-huh.
it was really sweet and bitter. And at the time, of course, I didn't know that, you know, I was, you know, quote, foraging. But I just thought it was really tasty and cool.
Uh-huh.
And then fast forward 25 years, when my friend took me foraging for wild food, it's quite magical. And I try to hesitate to use that word magical when it relates to mushrooms because everyone goes there.
Right, exactly.
So, you know, it is. It's really fun. There's a mystery. And when you are able to start unlocking those little clues, it becomes quite empowering and exciting and exhilarating.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, I guess I do it for a lot of reasons, and one of them is because it provides me with singular focus with a reward at the end, if that makes any sense.
Yeah.
No, I totally get that, because there's some risk involved. Because, I mean, there's risk in eating packaged foods. There's risk in going out to dinner.
Probably more risk than that.
But we have, you know, we're so... sort of civilized, right? And
yeah.
I think a lot of people have fear in taking that risk because even though, you know...
Well, yeah, exactly.
Like, there's just such a power... We're so disconnected from our foraging sort of biology
selves,
and selves that I think we fear it more than we do what we should fear, which is like processed food, you know?
Right.
Yeah.
So I'm curious about taste.
I remember
one time
I came home and offered my roommate some wild raspberries. They grow like crazy here.
Mm-hmm.
And he wouldn't eat them. He didn't trust me.
Oh.
And it was just quite funny because I was like, so you trust the guy or the gal at the grocery store stocking, you know, whatever food
right.
that
yeah.
they wash their hands, et cetera. But you don't trust the guy you live with.
Right.
Which I thought was kind of interesting.
Yeah.
But I think it's pretty common. You know, I think I think it's pretty common to have a little bit of that skepticism. I remember my mom telling the story.
Well, I was just going to say the mom warnings of like, don't eat this, don't eat that.
Yes.
You know, like as a little kid, when you're in your yard and you're like.
And children are much more adventurous. My own son ate taxus berries, Michael. You know, which are super toxic. And when
but
I asked,
they look delightful.
They look like little, you know, and they're juicy. And I, when I said, why did you eat that? He goes, I was hungry, you know? So,
yeah. I had similar experience with my mother, you know, afraid of the mushroom in the yard. I just remember that. And now that I have more information and I'm more tapped into that, I actually suspect that that was an edible mushroom, although I probably wouldn't eat it because of the, you know, pesticides and fertilizers in the neighborhood. But,
right.
But I think that it's interesting, you know, I think it's healthy to have skepticism about what you eat. It's just a matter of how you apply that.
So is there like a golden rule to follow when you're out in the woods and you're looking around at all the plant material? How do you know? I mean, obviously you have a book with you and, you know, how do you do it? Let's just ask the simple question.
You know, books are helpful, but they don't, you know, answer everything. I've, over the years, have gained a lot of experience by going with people who have done it.
Mm-hmm.
And so you gain little tiny tricks and tips over the years of, oh, well, this mushroom, if you cut it, when the flesh is exposed to oxygen, it stains this color. Or this mushroom looks like an edible mushroom, but if you flip it over and you see the gill structure is a little different, you learn little tips. There is no one rule when you're foraging. It's not mine, but I do use this kind of adage, if you will, that was given to me, which is basically there are old mushroom hunters and there are bold mushroom hunters, but there are no old and bold mushroom hunters.
Yes. I think that's a good adage, actually.
So, yeah. I mean, there's a lot of people, when you get into the mushroom, especially the mushroom foraging culture, because there is one, there are a lot of people who are kind of left or right politically, and a lot of them have strong opinions about politics. They also have strong opinions about foraging. And it's really interesting when you come across people, because there's a lot of different views on foraging, and it would actually be a pretty good book to write, I bet.
Well, there you go. That's, there's your future.
Yeah.
Tell me a little bit about the term wildcrafting.
That's a new word for me. I started working at this herb school in Boulder last year, and that's where I first heard it. I learned it from an ethnobotanist, and I guess it's just the act of, you know, going out into the nature and you know, finding your own food and finding your own medicine. I think it mostly relates to medicine. So I don't know any of the etymology of it. Or
okay.
Anything.
So other than mushrooms, are you eating leafy plants as well? And obviously fruits, raspberries, but...
Yeah. Right now, Boulder County is experiencing an exceptional year of apples, which is kind of cool.
Mm-hmm.
And it's been interesting. There's a lot of cool websites out there. I can't think of one right now, but there's one where there's a map of the United States that shows all of the public land and all the public fruit trees. And that's pretty cool. You may have talked about this before, but I eat, you know, there's wild lettuce in my yard. There's wild spinach in my yard.
Uh-huh.
You know, you like elderflowers. They aren't native to the area, but you know, I find them in May and I make a cordial with it. There's lots of cool stuff. If you just start to pay attention and start to inquire, you will start to unlock what nature has given us.
Right.
And I think there needs to be an adjustment in taste, right? Especially since we've grown up with so much processed food and so much, such a limited sort of palette of plants. There's like probably 50 species that we eat, you know, 50, like every day, you know, or every week. So what have you found In terms of comparing taste of greens, wild greens versus the stuff that's sort of farm grown, what has been your experience in adjusting to those kinds of tastes?
Well, first I want to say that all of those processed foods originally came from the wild.
Yes.
And we process them to make them more palatable, which I think is the what your question is.
Yes.
And so what can you expect when you're outside and you're in the wilderness and you're eating wild food? Well, you can expect really intense flavors mm-hmm. from small things.
Mm-hmm.
For example, wild strawberries grow everywhere. And, you know, I did hear a story not too long ago on NPR or some program about, you know, strawberries were hybridized many, many, you know, maybe 200 years ago.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Larger and more tasty.
Yeah.
And so it was like a combination of some, you know, bland, large fruit with some super small, tasty fruit. And the super small fruit is what is native to Colorado, at least. You'll see these strawberries that are the size of your pinky nail.
Yeah, I've had those. They're lovely.
You know, that little tiny bite has so much flavor in it. And, you know, you mentioned earlier about umami.
Yes.
The wild mushrooms that we find, particularly porcini and white matsutake, have extreme flavors.
Yeah.
And they're really, I mean, that's kind of, you know, I come from a service industry culinary background, so these flavors are really incredible, which is one reason I'm attracted to it, because it's truly gourmet. It's truly as nature intended.
Yeah, that's what I love about eating
well,
that.
Well, the morels, if you can find morels, those are, it's indescribable.
Yeah.
The taste is indescribable.
And like a truffle,
yeah.
You know, like the that certain...
And a real truffle.
A real
right.
truffle. You know, when my family's from Italy, Michael, and when we go there, we happen to go there during truffle season, and they're just shaving a piece, you know, shaving
yeah.
some of it right onto your pasta or whatever you're eating. And there's something so incredible. And also the fact that it's rare,
mm-hmm.
you know, it makes it extra special. It's like intense
yeah.
and rare and seasonal, you know, all the things that make it beautiful. And in Italy, they have those tiny strawberries, too,
yeah.
in the mountains. And after eating those, I can't even eat those
farm Driscoll.
They taste
gross.
Horrible. You
yeah.
have to, you have to like soak them in liqueur.
You
or
have to put
you know,
so much sugar on them.
yeah. yeah, my family yeah. puts you know, like liqueur on them. Like
salt
to you know?
Bring out the taste, yeah.
But it's amazing how different wild flavors are, you know?
Oh, yeah. There's purslane. There's, like I said, spinach. There's bee balm. There's so many things that
dandelion.
You can go
yeah.
and enhance your meal. And, you know, I do think, obviously, there's a place for organic and biodynamic. And,
mm-hmm.
And you know, you can totally taste the difference between those kinds of products and conventional products. In fact, I won't eat tomatoes if it's not August or September.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
So,
terrible.
You know, there are places for that. And wild, for me, is, you know, kind of part adventure / part, you know, gourmet. And I think truly, for me, like one of the best gourmet meals is when you're out and maybe you're fishing and you catch a wild, you know, Rocky Mountain trout. And then, you know, that same day you find yourself a patch of chanterelle mushrooms or morels or whatever it is, and you make that. That's
yeah.
right there. I think you could charge, you know, thousands of dollars a plate.
You've just taken me to a little magical place, Michael.
I ate a Rocky yeah. Mountain trout about, I would say, 20 years ago, hiking in Rocky Mountain National Park. And
uh-huh.
it was a small one, and it was divided amongst four people, but it was an incredible taste.
Well, I
know?
Think also, I think food, when you have to work for it,
oh, yeah.
I think there's
yeah.
more of a reward, you know? And
yeah, it's even one step further than just cooking it, because you
yeah.
can go and you can take a recipe and put it together, and it tastes great, and it's really rewarding. But even, you know, the act of going and finding or hunting for it is that much more rewarding.
Exactly. Well, and I think we're also so removed from our physical selves, you know, so the act of walking and hiking and fishing and, you know, needing that sustenance, you know,
and it, possibly not finding it.
Right.
You know, like wanting it,
right.
the desire, you know.
Right. I think it's as much mental as it is physical, you know?
Yeah. We had a Eugenia Bone on who wrote the book Mycophilia, which you probably read. And she talks about how she got drawn in, you know. I think she was just, she started with just, you know, an interest, a sort of casual interest. And then she became like president of her local mycological society. You know, she just became obsessed.
Yeah. How did you get interested particularly into mushrooms?
I guess it probably has a bunch of roots to it.
Pardon the pun. Right.
I mean, I grew up hunting animals with my father in western Nebraska.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, then that later manifested in other ways. For, you know, example, I like hunting for vinyl records and estate shopping and thrift store shopping. And then, you know, my interest in nature combined with my, you know, treasure hunting, I don't know what you want to call it, but then when somebody opened the door and it was morel mushrooms that I first went hunting for, and it was kind of just all of that combined, and then, you know, the road has led me to, you know, where I'm at right now, which, you know, I work at a restaurant in Boulder called The Kitchen, and it's really cool because, you know, I can go out and forage for my wild foods, and then I can turn around and, you know, if they want to, they'll buy that from me. And then, you know, that night I'm telling a table or telling somebody at my bar that, hey, listen, this is a mushroom that I foraged this morning. So it kind of all just happened at the same time. And I don't know how to explain it, except it was a bunch of different things.
Well, it's that it's a beautiful statement. And let's also then talk about the physicality of mushroom hunting, right? And how everything does come together, the mycelium of life.
Yeah. Well, I guess it's interesting. I think, you know, like I said, treasure is part of this. You know, there are mushrooms that we could cultivate. I think there's about 100 species that we can cultivate as a human race, scientific body. We can cultivate 100 species. And the ones that you find in the store, some of those are the ones that you can cultivate. So, you know, the button mushrooms, the oyster mushrooms, shiitake, maitake, lion's mane, all of these you can cultivate because of their specific biology.
Mm-hmm.
The ones that you can't really cultivate, although I think there's one dude in Denmark who has figured out how to grow morel mushrooms. These mushrooms, like the ones that you find at Whole Foods for $50 a pound, for example, chanterelle mushrooms, porcini mushrooms, matsutake mushrooms, lobster mushrooms, all of these mushrooms, at least specific to Colorado, and I know they grow, you know, all over the nation. We also get morel mushrooms here. These are the ones that you can't cultivate because of their biology and because of how they actually depend on their ecosystem. So I often joke, you know, it's called mycorrhizal. Mm-hmm. Myco means mushroom, rhizal meaning root. These, you know, about 90% of the Earth's plants have a mycorrhizal relationship. It's a symbiotic thing where, you know, the mushrooms are able to find more water and minerals and bring that to the tree, and the tree is able to send sugars to the mushroom. And these forests that you go looking for mushrooms in, I often joke about, if I wanted to be like the gourmet mushroom farmer, I would just buy a forest and just say I'm a farmer. Because you can't really grow them in a laboratory setting or in a farm setting. They need these 40, 50, 80-year-old trees in order to live. And why they're gourmet and why they're choice is because they only fruit for a specific amount of time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So, like I said with the tomato, I won't eat tomatoes if they're not in season.
Similarly,
you can't really get, you know, porcinis if it's not July or August in the Rocky Mountains. You can't get matsutake unless it's late August, September. Chanterelles have a very small season, and that's why it's so exciting. And you're right, like, just going out and finding them in their proper setting is really exciting. You line up all these things, and they're doing what they're supposed to do, and you just go look for them.
Right. I mean, it really is, it's cosmic in a way.
And
very
magical.
Because it's very specifical.
Yeah.
Specific, right.
Yeah, and it is magical.
Yeah.
You know, and you return to the same spot, and 1 year it might not be there. right?
Right. This year I had a terrible year for porcinis, but this year happened to be a great year for chanterelles.
Yeah.
So,
yeah,
you know, you take what you can get.
Tomato, tomato.
And I think I just think the mystery adds to the taste. I mean, yeah. I just, you know, I think it's great that it's, you know, that it's just not a given. You know, you're not going to go down a row and just pull out a bunch of mushrooms.
Right.
Yeah. And I like to premise all of my classes with that, you know.
Yeah.
Hey, it's Mother Nature. She decides.
Exactly.
You know, we get to go walk around and enjoy her. And if she wants to offer anything, then we get to, you know, enjoy it.
Exactly. All right.
That much more.
Hang on, Michael. We have to take a break. But when we come back, I want to hear how you actually do grow some mushrooms, though, because you have had some success doing that as well. So hang on. You're listening to We Dig Plants on Heritage Radio Network.
Today's program has been brought to you by Chefs Collaborative and their annual Sustainable Food Summit. This year is the 6th annual Sustainable Food Summit, Moving Mountains, Scaling Change, and we hope you'll join them and us at the end of the month. The summit brings hundreds of chefs and food professionals together from across the country to share ideas and get inspired. It's a powerful opportunity to connect in person with community members that share a commitment to help fix America's broken food system. For 3 days at the end of September, we're going to explore Colorado's dynamic culinary landscape as we help learn new ways to scale up sustainable ventures and strengthen our commitment to changing the ways we source, cook, and serve food. Learn more at chefscollaborative.org.
We're thrilled to announce a special event, the Silver Snail 25 Years of Slow Food. This event is hosted by Slow Food USA, Heritage Radio Network, and Roberta's Pizza. It's been 25 years since Carlo Petrini and a group of activists launched a peaceful revolution to defend regional traditions, good food, gastronomic pleasure, and the slow pace of life. The slow food movement has since evolved into a comprehensive approach to food that recognizes strong connections between plate, planet, people, politics, and culture. Today, this movement involves thousands of projects and millions of people in more than 160 countries worldwide. Join us for a dialogue between Slow Food's founder, Carlo Petrini, and locavore activist, Alice Waters, as they reflect on the evolution of the food movement and all things slow. Friday, October 3rd from 11:30 to 2:30. You can go to our website and click on the link on the right-hand side of the page to RSVP. We can't wait to see you there.
Hi, welcome back to We Dig Plants on the Heritage Radio Network. We're here with chef and mixologist Michael Heim from Boulder, Colorado, talking about mushrooms and foraging. So, Michael, let's talk about your mushrooms that you're actually growing. You've started a sort of small mushroom farm pretty recently, right?
I actually didn't start it. I took over for a friend who did start it.
Ah.
He started it 2 years ago.
Okay.
And so, yeah, I worked with him for a little bit while he and his wife were preparing to move out east. And so now I do actually operate it, yeah.
And what are you growing?
Presently, I am growing shiitake, oyster mushroom. I have some lion's mane in culture. I have reishi. I have some turkey tail. I have some morel mycelium growing, although that's, you know, almost impossible. So, yeah, just a few things. When I took over, Jared is his name. He really is just ambitious, and he had, you know, 15 different varieties. His background is medicinal, so he's a Chinese medical practitioner.
Oh, okay.
And so he had a lot of different medicinal mushrooms in culture, and I kind of put those on hold because at this point I'm still learning how to grow, so I wanted to focus my attention on one or two so that I could grow them really well, and obviously we want to turn this into a life business.
Okay.
Michael, the phone is cutting in and out a little bit.
Can you hear me now?
Oh, that's better.
That's much better. Thanks.
So you're focusing on culinary now, a couple of different types of culinary, for medicinal use as well?
Yeah, well, there are some that have both properties. Mm-hmm. Shiitake in particular has, and you know, this is obviously this is all new to me, the growing part, but shiitake, I think, has specific anti-cancer properties.
Okay.
If I don't remember the specifics, but I did remember hearing about a town in Japan that was basically, I don't want to say immune, but had lower cancer rates than everyone around them, and they discovered it was because the shiitake mushroom farm there, all the farmers were taking home the twos and threes, if you know that those terms where it relates to fruit, back to their family, and they were eating it, and so everyone in the community was pretty much safe from cancer, whereas everyone surrounding that community had higher cancer rates.
So they were kind of
shiitake would be one.
Okay.
I am growing reishi, which is pretty much the first thing you study when you start studying Chinese medicine. Reishi is known as like the 10,000 year mushroom in ancient China. If you were caught transporting this mushroom and you weren't en route to the king or emperor, you were most likely executed. These are pretty potent mushrooms. I'm trying to focus on those and oysters. Oysters are pretty much the easiest mushroom to grow. And I think in an earlier part of the segment, you were talking about the group from New York who started growing mycelium for packaging.
That's right.
And,
yes.
And it's similar. You know, you find a substrate, typically. Well, I'll speak for myself. I grow them on spent coffee grounds. So there's a really cool coffee shop in town that will just let me come by once a week and pick up their coffee grounds, wood chips, straw, and then lately I've been using cork from work. So some of these wine corks, we save all of them. We used to recycle them, but now I'm starting to grow mushrooms on them, which is cool.
Awesome.
So tell me a little bit about the process. So you have this base material, the substrate, you said. How does it go? What's the sort of step-by-step process, if you don't mind sharing, actually from the beginning to the final?
Yeah, sure. So you can start by either going online and buying culture. You can shop for chaga, or you can shop for reishi, or you can shop for, you know, king oyster. Any of these mushrooms are available online. Or if you want to do it, I think the more pure way and the more, I guess, sustainable way would be to go out into the wild and hunt for mushrooms. And when you are able to lock down on one and say, oh, I know this is exactly, you know, this mushroom, you can take that mushroom back to the lab. We'll call it a lab. And you can do it in two ways. You can take the mushroom, and if it has a gill structure, you can turn it on its, you could take the gills facing down onto a piece of paper and let the gills shoot spores onto the paper. And spores are the seeds. These are the seeds that create the mycelium, which in turn creates the mushroom.
Right.
So that's one way of doing it. There is a lot of risk for contamination, so a lot of this has to be done in front of a flow hood that puts out pure air. And then, you know, obviously you want to keep your hands clean and et cetera. But so the other method is you can take, actually there's two more methods that I know of. You can take a piece of the actual mushroom, and cells do what they do. They reproduce. So you can take this piece of mushroom, typically you'll take it from somewhere on the stalk. Usually you can take it from the base of the stipe or stalk, whatever you want to call it, and you can put it onto a petri dish. Same thing with the spores. Once you have the spores, you can scrape them onto a sterilized petri dish with agar. And so once the spores or the flesh of the stipe hit the petri dish in a sterilized condition, they can start to reproduce and make more of itself. So they start turning into mycelium. And once that's at a healthy stage, sometimes you have a very vigorous, you know, mycelium that even fruits in the actual petri dish.
Wow.
But from there, you can take, you know, bits of this agar that's been inoculated with mycelium, and you could put it into sterilized, like I said earlier, I have a mixture of coffee grounds, straw, wood chips, and cork. So we sterilize that in an autoclave or a pressure cooker or whatever you want to call it. And then you introduce, I skipped a step. Before you go from petri dish to the bag of substrate, you can take a jar and put some sort of grain in there. Most times I use wheat berries. I get wheat berries from a farm down the road. And you can sterilize these wheat berries, make sure they're moist, and then you take a piece of this petri, this inoculated agar, and you add it to these wheat berries, and you cover it with a filter. And then in 3 weeks, 4 weeks' time, this whole jar, this whole mason jar is filled with inoculated wheat berries. So these are all individual points of inoculation.
I've seen that. Yeah. I've seen in researching mycelium, I've seen that, those jars.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and you can fruit from that jar if you'd like. You can, you know, open it up, and I've done this before. You can open it up, and mushrooms will fruit.
Hmm.
Or the other thing is with a mason jar, with like a pint or even a liter mason jar, you can take that and you can inoculate 5 to 10 bags of substrate and get that much more out of it.
Wow.
And it just, you can continue to go in stages even after I've got a, you know, like let's say a 4-gallon bag that has been sterilized and then inoculated, and now it's totally fruited, or the mycelium has permeated this bag. You can take that and add it to a larger bag. So I've even had big, giant columns hanging in the lab that have been inoculated with oyster mushrooms. And then at that point, once that is permeated, then you can start, it starts to fruit, and then you start, you know, collecting fruit from that for weeks.
Wow. And you can just keep on doing it.
Other options include, you can take these wheat berries, and you can take wood dowels, like furniture dowels.
Yeah.
And you can inoculate these furniture dowels with the mycelium. You can drill holes into fresh poplar family trees, so anything like a cottonwood, anything in the poplar family, you can drill holes in these freshly cut poplar trees, and you can pound these inoculated dowels into the tree, and in 5 months, you have a tree that is fruiting like oyster mushrooms or whatever you've inoculated it with.
That would be fun. And what are the conditions? It has to be outdoors, I assume, right?
Yeah, you can do that outdoors.
You can't do it to your indoor furniture.
What'd you say?
You can't go inoculating your dining room your table legs.
No. You want to avoid anything that's been treated, obviously. And,
right.
You know, we were talking about...
I just want to clarify.
But I'd like to see that in the New York City parks.
Yeah, that would be interesting. You'd probably go to jail if you started doing that. So cottonwoods, so the ones that we can grow, these mushrooms that we can grow, they fall in the category of mushroom called the saprophyte. And sapros in Greek means putrid, or, it alludes to a damaged tree. Let's just say that.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So when oyster mushrooms or shiitake mushrooms or reishi mushrooms, these are saprophytes. When they land in nature, they land in wounds. For example, in the mountains, let's say a bear was clawing at a tree. That opens the tree up. It's wounded. Spores are everywhere. They land on the tree, and then they make a home.
It's a host, right.
Yeah, and so the tree, essentially, this dead or dying tree, we talked maybe a little bit earlier about mushrooms and how they are kind of the gatekeeper of life and death. Without mushrooms, we don't have soil.
Right.
Oh,
so
yeah.
The lignin and cellulose have to be broken down some way in nature, and that's where mycelium and mushrooms come into play. So mycelium lands in a wounded tree, and it starts the process of breaking down trees. And so, yeah, you couldn't do your chair at home because that tree doesn't have the nutrients it, or that, you know, wood doesn't have the nutrients it once did.
Right. Yeah, I just wanted to clarify so people don't think, oh, I've got this poplar table and I'm going to, you know, pound some inoculated mushrooms in there.
Right, yeah. It takes, it, you know, it has to be somewhat fresh with regards to some of these sacrifices, you know, and there's different stages of sacrifice, which is kind of cool. And I understand this is a garden show. If you were to be serious about, you know, growing mushrooms, you could do it with the sacrifice on trees in your garden in different stages. There's first, there's primary decomposers, there's secondary decomposers, there's tertiary decomposers, and you can get fruit at each stage all the while you're creating soil, which is kind of cool.
Michael, this is you're a wealth of information. It's amazing to have you on. We have to kind of wrap things up, but tell us a little bit about the Chef's Collaborative Dinner, and are you participating in that and helping them with a fabulous meal?
Yeah, hopefully. You know, we're a little late in the season. I wish the Chef's Collaborative was maybe last month, but I will say, I was lucky enough to be invited to, I have what they're calling a breakout session.
Okay.
Monday, I think, I don't remember what time it's at, but, you know, it's essentially I'm taking people into the woods, and I'm hopefully going to give them a little lesson on, you know, key characteristics for identifying mushrooms. I know that currently we do have chanterelle mushroom and matsutake mushroom still fruiting. I hope the weather stays, you know, somewhat warm. But, yeah, if we find some cool stuff, we'll be bringing it to the dinner on Monday night. I guess there's a big dinner. So hopefully, you know, that's my involvement.
Yeah. Well, I wish I could come on that tour with you. And
that would be so great.
Spend some more time with you because you are you're so fun. It would be amazing to take your class and learn from you. And maybe we can get you out to New York to
to forage.
to do some foraging.
Well, you know, that's funny. Last year I went to a Telluride Mushroom Festival, and Gary Linkoff,
who is your
mushroom guy, he led us on some groups. And he told me stories when I went on a foray with him about, you know, foraging in Central Park.
Yeah.
So you might get that guy to take you guys out.
Because I
know there are mushrooms growing in your neighborhood.
I actually took a soil science class with him at the New York Botanic Garden.
He's a great guy. And I've been doing this for a very long time. And you've inspired me, Michael, because just randomly, as a birthday present, my sister-in-law sent a morel growing kit. So I started reading about it, and it seems so intimidating, you know?
So I think Carmen's going to be emailing you with some questions.
I think I'm going to email.
That's okay. You know, I think the idea with anything that you're passionate about, at least for me, is just try and learn something new every time you do it.
Right.
And each year I learn so much more, and I still feel like I don't know anything relative to people like Gary Linkoff and, you know, Robert Rogers and David Aurora, all these big names in mycology. I don't know anything.
Yeah, so. but I think that's what life is about. You know what I mean? It's attaching on and learning, right?
Yeah, and they have to pass the knowledge on.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And it's one of those things, like you were saying as well, you can look at the books. You can look at the foraging books, you can look at the mushroom books, but it's only from the knowledge passed on person to person that I think you really get it. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I think it's cool. I mean, I haven't made that connection before, but yeah, it's kind of like oral tradition in Native society.
Yes, yeah, absolutely.
You know, you're learning a specific skill. It's still, you know, it's right now it doesn't feel like survival, but you know, it could, you know, could be cool.
Yeah.
To, you know, turn it into something like that.
Well, you just keep doing what you're doing, and it'll be fun to keep up with you. We signed up for your email list, so we'll be following you virtually, and we wish you good luck and have fun.
Happy hunting
at the at the Sustainable Food Summit. Thanks for joining us.
May I make one little plug?
Please, absolutely.
Yeah. So, like I said earlier, I kind of just took over for this small little mushroom farm.
Yeah.
And the website is bouldermushrooms.com.
Okay.
And are you shipping all over the states, or how?
I'm not quite there yet, but okay. I want to be. So okay. If anyone out there is interested in connecting with me, I'd definitely like to talk to them.
Okay.
Well, we'll put a link. I think I've already put a link to the to the farm yesterday.
Cool. 63rd Street Farm.
Yeah.
Yeah. So. Yeah. That's part of it. That's actually where I have my lab.
Your lab.
So they're really great people. They let me work there.
Well, Michael, if you want to send us some photos of your lab and what you're doing, we'll share them with our listeners.
Oh, that'd be great. I appreciate that.
Okay. Good luck, Michael. Thank you.
Yeah. Thanks. It was nice meeting you.
Okay. Have a good afternoon. You've been listening to We Dig Plants on the Heritage Radio Network. Happy gardening. Tune in next week.
And happy shrooming.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions anytime at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a 501c3 nonprofit. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.